Welcome back to another episode of Chaotic Harmony, and to those entering back the classrooms this week, welcome back. Couple things. First off, today you're in for a treat. We have an interview with Olivia Ramirez, who is a phenomenal teacher. I do want to let you know, it is a bit of a longer one, and sometimes we like to cut these longer ones into smaller parts, but listening back, I feel like it would be a disservice for us to cut this one in parts. So strap in. You've got a great episode. Olivia is a wonderful person, and we have a really good talk. But also, I do want to let you know, Olivia lives in Texas, and so we're trying this Zoom interview approach. And so do bear with us. The audio quality is not the same level as we do like it to be, but we're trying to figure out these technical kinks since there are so many great teachers out there that do not live in the California area. And as much as I'd love to travel and interview them in person, sometimes it's just more feasible to do the Zoom. So bear with our audio quality. We will eventually get it to a pristine level that we do love to record. That all said, I bring to you. Welcome to Chaotic Harmony. My name is John.
This is Crystal. We talk about the joys and the challenges of teaching music in the elementary school classroom.
We share struggles, we brainstorm solutions.
And we would love to have you join us.
Live from the digital space, welcome to another Chaotic Harmony episode 95. I'm your host today, Jonathan Seligman. And today I have a special guest, your friend, my friend, everyone's friend. Sorry, who are you again?
Olivia Ramirez.
Hey, hi, Olivia. It's good to see you. Oddly enough, I've known Olivia for a very short time. We met North Charleston, is that correct? That's where we met?
I think so.
Yeah.
It was like fangirled a little bit. I'm a longtime listener. I was like, I know you.
Listener, one-time commenter right now. do you even remember what the session was?
It was something about student teaching.
That's right.
And there were very teaching. Few people in it. Mm-hmm. And I walked in and you were sitting there and I was like, oh my gosh, like I know who that is.
It's still weird. It's still weird. I'm just me. Hi. But so anyways, just to those who didn't get it, Olivia, you've been listening for a while and it's been really cool because like you shared yours right there. Like we just had a really good conversation about where we're at. And I've been wanting to have you on this podcast. I feel like we clicked, like not that, I don't think then, but the next ORF session, we definitely clicked. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wanted to have you on for a while. We've just been doing live recordings. I even debated, should I fly out to Texas?
You should.
I mean, maybe we'll have to do a second parter separate from all this stuff. But so we're trying out this whole new spiel, more digital content or either like online content. And so if you're a listener and you want it to be interviewed by either Crystal, myself, or someone else, hit us up, chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com. That all said, this isn't about me. Or is this? This is about you, Olivia. So you're over in Texas. Texas is huge.
Very big.
Remind me. It's our audio listeners, apparently.
This is Texas.
Okay.
And I think, I don't know if it's going to flip it, but if this is Texas, I am like here.
So it's so fascinating that Texas has the hand thing. I think the only other state that I know that does a hand thing is Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Is the whole upper
do you live
thumb.
On the thumb?
Is there any other states? Because California is like a J, so I don't even know if anything.
I mean, you could do all those like Wyoming and Colorado. They're all squares.
Yeah. One of the squares, rectangles. So where are you on the Texas?
I'm in North Texas, specifically Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay. Cool. And have you always been in that area? Did you grow up in that area or?
No, I grew up in Houston in a suburb of a suburb of a suburb of Houston.
Can you show
Houston.
Me the hand again? Where is Houston?
So Houston's like down here. Okay. Kind of like I was like halfway between Houston and Galveston.
So by the Palm.
By the Palm. Okay. Down here. And then I went to Texas Christian University for my bachelor's and stayed in Fort Worth. Got a job and stayed.
Okay. Cool. So before we begin to the meat of the episode, like first off, how long have you been teaching? Like, what's your school like? Just give us the program notes. Yeah. So where are you teaching at right now?
I am opening a brand new school. Right, like, they are still working on it. Right now, they're building it in Aledo, Texas, which is just west of Fort Worth. And I have taught in this district before, but it's kind of been a journey. So Yeah, so this is Alito. Am I telling you my whole journey?
Yeah, go for it. I mean, yeah. So it's you've been, have you taught there before? Like,
I have.
okay,
So when
expound.
I graduated from TCU, oh my gosh, I'm embarrassed. Go Frog. I graduated from TCU and I got a job out in Alito and I was teaching private lessons and like assisting the band program. And then I did that for 2 years and then took over the percussion program. And I was teaching 6th through 12th grade, all percussion classes, running the drum line, percussion ensembles. Everything was before or after school. Every weekend I had something and I loved it. Like that's what I thought I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And then I got married, started having some kids, and priorities started shifting. So when my husband wanted to go back to school to pursue a career change, I realized I couldn't sustain what I was doing and support him in that. So it was like, well, elementary hours look better, so let's try it out.
Okay.
And I left the district because there weren't any elementary jobs at the time. But there was a woman, the deputy superintendent at the time, her name's Lynn McKinney. She was like, "You're a Bearcat for life. Come back as soon as you can." And this is one of those like real small towns where they have one mascot for every campus.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Bearcat. Everyone's a Bearcat.
So just like based off grade level, you're a Bearcat, mini
Everyone's a
Bearcat.
Bearcat. There's
Okay.
Bearcat country. Everyone's a Bearcat.
Gotcha.
And so yeah, I left the district, found a job teaching elementary. I always say I bamboozled someone into hiring me because he knew me from my work as a band director. And in my interview, he was like, "You're smart, you'll figure it out." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I got hired to do a job I don't know how to do." And I was working in a district that had a very healthy ORF community. And they were like, "Come to an ORF meeting." And I was like, "What is that?" Sure. I don't know what I'm doing. And like that was the beginning of the
So just backpedaling. So first off,
end.
you taught for at the secondary level for how many years?
For 5 years.
For 5 years, and then you pivoted just to make because like w to those who aren't really entrenched in the secondary community, like myself for a long time, you say it's heavy hours. Like, what were the hours like for secondary
I
education?
literally had something before and after school every day. And I feel like my position was unique in that, like, a high school band director has a pretty heavy schedule, but they only have to do high school things. And a middle school band director only has to do middle school things. But as the percussion specialist over all 6th through 12th grade programs, I
Gotcha.
was at every middle school event, at the beginner concerts, before and after school for everything, region band auditions, concerts, if there were recitals or fundraisers. And then on top of my band duties, if I wanted to do percussion specific things, which is why we do these things, because that stuff was really fun, but that was on top of my duties. So every day before and after school and every weekend. Yeah, it was, I mean, I loved it,
Yeah,
but
yeah.
it was unsustainable.
It seems like it wasn't just something that you did out of the goodness of your heart or something it was passion project per se. It was expected of you to do that. Is that correct?
Yeah. And my husband and I had that conversation when I was considering leaving. He's like, "Why don't you just cut back?" And especially in that community, it's a very achievement-driven community. High expectations and lot like the community values programs that win. And I knew that it was either do that or don't do the job at all. But there was no middle ground. Like cutting back was just not an option. At least for where I was in my career, there are people smarter than me who have figured out some longevity in that career, but I just pivoted
Okay.
and
And then, so then you jumped into elementary and you've been teaching elementary for how long?
this will be year 7.
Woo! So 11 years teaching. Or sorry, 12. I know math.
This will be 12.
This will be 12. Okay. Wow. Cool. And so you've taught, and then only this coming year, you will be going back to the community you taught in, but
Yes,
for
and it's something
elementary.
special.
Yeah.
Yes, so it's the school is named after Lynn McKinney, who's the one who
Oh,
said,
wow.
"Come back."
Okay.
So when I found out they were naming the school after her, like it was tugging at my heart. And I had been at our actually the school that our house is zoned for the last 2 years, and I was really happy there. But then this opportunity came about,
Gotcha.
and I couldn't not put my hat my name in the hat. So everything just worked out beautifully. And it's, yeah, the building is still kind of under construction.
Okay.
We have school next Wednesday.
Oh, next week. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So it was like just like the element of homecoming, or do you think it was like, was it the seeds that that former teacher put in you? Did that come back, or were you just feeling it was time for a shift?
I felt like it was time for a shift, definitely. And coming back to it, like I feel so much peace. And there's a lot of people that I remember from when I was there. So it does feel like a homecoming. It's definitely different because I'm not in the role that I was before. And so there's a lot of people that I may have overlapped with, but because I wasn't on the elementary side, sure. I don't know. But everyone is just so wonderful. This entire faculty is all handpicked by the principal. And she knows how to pick them good.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Also, just sorry, there are so many avenues to use of where I could go towards, but like, I think one thing that gets curious. So you are steeped into ORF. You are very steeped into ORF, it seems like. Where you're really just steeped into a lot of things. It seems since we've become Insta friends, like I've seen you've been very, very, very active in the elemental music creating community. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes. Like I said, I was my first foray into elementary. I had a bunch of ORF teachers just kind of take me under their wing. And I was able to start my ORF level one that following summer. And that just unlocked so many things. Obviously like activities and lesson ideas for students, but it just unlocked something in me, like as a human, to be willing to be vulnerable and to be willing to ask questions, because so much of my experience as an educator up to that point was just tinged by imposter syndrome and not wanting to ask questions, because if I ask that question, then they'll know that I don't belong here. They'll know that I don't know what I'm doing. The veil will be dropped and then they're just going to run me out of town. Like that was the voice in my head. Yeah. And it really started with ORF level one. I remember like coaching myself, like go in, be vulnerable, just learn to like open up to these people, just do whatever they ask you to do. Like I'm like in the car before walking in every day, just coaching myself. But that was a huge area of growth just as a human. I know lots of people say that ORF changed them as a human, and it's things like that where you put yourself out there and you might even falter or fail, and you realize that you just get back up again and that there's people to pick you up and you can lean on and you can ask questions and you can say, I struggle with this thing, but it looks like you figured out a solution. Can you help me?
Yeah, that's awesome. It seems like you had a really strong community in the area that you were teaching your first year of elementary school. Is that apt?
Yes. And that's I was there good. For 4 years.
Something that piques my curiosity is because you were so long in the secondary space, so long, relatively speaking, and you jump over to elementary, you dive right in. And I feel like something that happens between teachers who participate in levels, it's just to become binary for a second. Like either it's people either drink it all in, or they kind of get torn between what was, how they were taught, and what is. I guess actually, well, first off, were you taught in the ORF approach? Were you aware before doing ORF, like about this, or were you more in like what we like to call the conservatory approach?
I would say more of a conservatory approach. Certainly in my education at college or university, we were all education majors because our main professor recognized that that was the most marketable thing. But because we were all education majors, he just treated us like performance majors because nobody was allowed to be a performance major. And he didn't care what your career path was or what your desired career path was. Like he knew that the smart thing to do was to get you your education degree. And like, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that was brilliant. But we did get treated like performance majors. And what I've learned since switching over to elementary and taking a bunch of different workshops and courses, I just ask myself, like, why wasn't I taught this way? Like, this stuff makes sense now. And I know that it works for me as an adult. Like, if I had learned this as a young person, I would have gotten it. I wouldn't have struggled so much or had so much self-doubt or performance anxiety. I mean, like, you can't go back and change that, but I just think, like, why weren't we taught this way? It works.
Were you someone that definitely ate in, or like, I don't know the right, insert your metaphor here. Like, were you someone that absorbed really this, that old, like the conservatory approach, or were you someone that you knew what you wanted to do, but it was kind of like, this isn't exactly the way it doesn't fit me. Like, which one were you
I
more?
I think that all of that was revealed in hindsight.
Okay.
I definitely had a lot of performance anxiety in college, like to the point that I really have negative memories of college, like in general. Like, it was not the traditional college experience that like you see embodied in like movies or on TV. Like, I was just anxious all the time and didn't know that's what I was feeling. And like, I would want to practice, but I didn't want anyone to hear what I was practicing, because then like, again, like if they hear what I'm working on and then they like judge me, and should I even be here? And after the fact, like now I get to teach alongside some of my former peers at summer camps, and we talk about that stuff and how we were all feeling the same thing, but we weren't talking about it. I would say I had a pretty negative experience in college. And I think I think most of it was in my head, but like, I feel like I'm a pretty average performer. Like, I did the drum corps thing, but I had a lot of, imposter syndrome there. Like, do I belong here? Like, everyone here is just a monster player. And then there's me, like, how did I get in this group? So I think if I went back with what I know now, I may have seen it differently. But my experience was just this constant comparison to everyone else, and like this constant thought that like you don't live up to what they're doing. So coming into the ORF world and the elementary, like just elemental music in general, stripped all of that away. Like, what is like, a mistake is not the worst thing that you can do, and you can be vulnerable and you can even fail, and that is okay. And I think that's why I vibe so much with it. I was like, this is so freeing and healing, and like, this is therapeutic. Like, I think that may be why I connected so well with it, and I don't think I've ever put that into words before.
Well, you got a scoop right here, y'all. That's cool. For me, maybe I'm speaking for myself, but, and maybe there's others as well, but I feel like for myself, similarly, like taking level one was incredibly freeing. And going further into the levels was really eye-opening. It's like, similar to what you're saying, like, why wasn't I taught this way? Why was I taught a very specific approach, and we were all not even molded, we were forced into this approach. But I recognize that after the first few years, like, okay, I was given these tools, but I was still taught a certain way. And it's almost as if, like, you know how metal has memory, like people say that, like, and so like after time, I've been kind of torn between both the conservatory and also this ORF approach has that. And I've been trying to reconcile that. I still am, but I'm finding a middle ground for myself. Have you been, is that been like a dilemma, for lack of a better term, for you? Or did you, like, when you were washed by the waters of ORF and elemental music, or was that your path from here on?
I think that really was my path forward. So when I do go teach like drumline camps and kind of live that old life, I find myself feeling that anxiety. And when I'm around in social circles with people that I went to school with, I find myself kind of regressing in my mentality and making myself snap out of it. Like, but I like it, I don't know. It's just like, you get around those people who are, I hate to say triggers because it's not their fault, but like, you get around that. I mean, it is a trigger to be in that environment and just to start reverting back to the like voice of, you're not good enough, and you never fit in there, and you didn't belong there, and all the negative self-talk. But then like, I come around my elementary music friends and we're singing and happy to see each other and laughing and playing ukuleles. It's like a toggle, I guess, and I'm still working through that.
Yeah. So it seems like for what I'm gathering, like your combat, your struggle with imposter syndrome, which I feel like is a commonality for like so many people we talk to in the elementary music space, and maybe beyond, we haven't just talked to them, but like it seems like though, like you're, correct me if I'm wrong, your approach towards combating imposter syndrome and the voices that have been, that you've been struggling with, is really being entrenched with community members that have a similar kind of paradigm. Is that correct? That's cool.
Yes. I'll say I haven't tried this. I don't know if you've met Christina Reardon, but she's
another name.
Okay. She's pretty involved with AOSA, and her trick for imposter syndrome when that voice starts talking to her is she has a stuffed octopus in her classroom, and she pretends that it's the octopus saying those things to her, and she throws it across the room. But like, we've had long talks about imposter syndrome. I recently, yesterday, got lunch with a former student, and she's working in the music industry now and very green in it. And she's talking about how like she's in this male dominated field, and like, how do you struggle? Like, how do you overcome imposter syndrome? And I'm like, I mean, it's always there, but you learn to recognize it and name it for what it is. And, one thing that you need to know is that everyone experiences it. Like, even the people who you think have it so totally together and have it figured out, maybe it, like, I've noticed that like the more that I know, sometimes the worse my imposter syndrome gets. I mean, like, I hope that I never think that I have it figured out. And that's part of why I keep going to new workshops and trying to learn new methodologies. Like, I want to try to know as much as I can. Yeah. But yeah, imposter syndrome is something that absolutely everybody deals with. And I think we all kind of learn our own way to cope with it. But after having some experience with it, like learning to identify that voice and telling it to go away, or to affirm yourself, or to have others affirm you. Like,
or to throw it across the room.
Yeah, or throw the octopus across the room.
I love
Thank
that.
Thank you, Christina.
And I guess that's actually a perfect segue, my next point, because like over the summer, you were mentioning how like that's something that has been like your constant desire to seek is, or to learn more things, has been giving you insight in your in combating imposter syndrome. So this summer, it seems like you went beyond. Well, actually, about last summer, you took the masterclass, right?
I did two masterclasses.
Two? Okay. How was that?
Oh, they were amazing. I did the masterclass at SMU in Dallas with Beth Nelson and Chris Olson. And that was just a week of create. It was, I did that one completely for me. I saw Beth Nelson posted the description of what the class was going to be. And when we went around the room and we were talking about why we were there, I was like, I'm not here for my students. Like, I need this for me. And so that was a beautiful week of just making art and getting to express and create with other musicians and other adults. And so that had its own value, just that soul filling value. And then I went to Memphis, which is a whole other story. I met Charlie Tai at the AOSA conference in Kansas City. And we were talking about how I was teaching in this Title I school and was struggling with some things with the community and just kind of like figuring my community out. And his, long story short, his advice was get to Memphis. So I wrote to AOSA. They have their scholarship program where applications are due every January 15th. I don't know when this is posted, but if you're listening to this and it's not January 15th yet, you should apply for this.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
But yeah, I just wrote to AOSA and I was like, Charlie Tai said to go to Memphis. Can I have some money? And I didn't know who was going to be teaching the masterclass. I just knew he said to go. And they funded it fully, travel, food, the stay in the dorms, everything. It's amazing. And that was with Beth Ann Hepburn. And we went back to the roots of the shul work and talked about how this whole methodology came to be, what was happening in Europe before Orff started doing his work, what Orff was doing as a child, what was going on in the arts, and how everything was just a big experiment and that it wasn't designed for young children. That was something that came later. But yeah, we just went back to the roots and ended up creating, oh, I mean, we ended up creating a whole thing out of that, but it was with this historical context in mind. So a very different experience, but equally as valuable. And that kind of sparked my interest in digging a little deeper. We talked about what Jacques Dalcroze had done leading up to Karl Orff's work, because Dalcroze came like late 1800s. And so he kind of walked so that Orff could run.
He danced so that Orff could run.
Yes,
you know, bad pun. Sorry, you can whatever. Continue. Sorry.
Like winding it back, so there's, you know, there's so much overlap with people who worked with Dalcroze and then later with Orff. A lot of people in the dance community, Wigman and Laban, kind of overlapped with Orff and Dalcroze. And so I just kept kind of like that digging and trying to find more information. And so those master classes were fabulous, but then that kind of paved the way to me taking a different course this summer. So
before we get there, I just to kind of pedal back and correct you if I'm wrong, it seems like the master classes, while Levels is for the pedagogy, master classes is for the individual almost. It's like for them to really seep in the philosophy of what the Orff Schulwerk is supposed to be.
Yes. Yeah. Like one thing we talked about with Beth Nelson and Chris Olson was you've learned all the rules. You're here because you've taken all your levels. Like, we expect that you know all the rules. Now let's have fun.
Okay. Okay.
And so they really approached it as all those times in Orff Levels that you wanted to continue to develop that thing, but you had to move on to the next topic. We don't have to cover the criteria anymore. There is no syllabus. It's just make. Cool. And so that was really cool. Like, they brought some ideas to us. They taught us a few things, and then we just created based on that. And it was really, really cool.
That's awesome. And so that led you to this year, this summer, you were able to participate in Dalcroze certification. What do they call it exactly?
It's called the Dalcroze Academy. And one of the first things that we learned is that you cannot call yourself a Dalcroze teacher until you have your professional certificate. So I am working towards my Dalcroze professional certificate. And I can say that my lessons are Dalcroze inspired, but I cannot say that I am teaching Dalcroze lessons.
That's fair. Okay. Okay. And in a nutshell, to those who maybe missed out on our conversation with David Frigo, like back in season two, check that out. In your own words, I'll give you two sentences. I'll allow you two sentences, two periods. You can use as many commas or whatever, but what is Dalcroze? What is the heart of Dalcroze?
The heart of Dalcroze is embodying music.
You have one more sentence.
I only needed one.
Ooh. Okay, embodying
music.
That
is truly the heart, embodying music.
So that is your thesis. Now give me the three paragraphs.
So we express music through the body. Mm-hmm. This winding all the way back to how this came about. Emil Dalcroze was teaching at a conservatory, the theory oral skills class, and he noticed that his conservatory students were very technically proficient at their instruments, but were not expressive or musical. And so he just started experimenting. He was a real playful guy, and he was like, put the instruments away, take off your shoes, let's move. And so everything he was doing was experimental, but it was about expressing music in the body. And if it's in your body, then when you pick up your instrument or use your voice, that comes through, and you use your instrument as an instrument instead of the instrument being your voice. Your voice is here, and it comes through whatever you use to express that.
Yeah, it reminds me of when we had Josh Southard on our podcast talking about his son who, you know, for specifically Orff, like how he was raised in the Orff approach. And then as soon as we went to middle school, it's like, even though he wasn't taught all of the stuff that we were taught in the conservatory approach, like, oh yeah, I know it because it's in my body already. I know X, Y, and Z. So I could just change the words and actually apply it to what the band works. Sorry, Josh, if I forgot what instrument he's taking, but yeah, it's like, so it's in the body already. So you can just transfer it easily. That's cool. In what way then does Dahlcrows differentiate from the Schulwerk?
I really worked on unpacking that. Mm-hmm. They overlap a lot. Like, it's very evident the influence that Dahlcrows' work had on Karl Orff and Gunnlod Kapemann and everything they were doing at the Gunther-Schule. I would say that the differences are the emphasis in each approach. In Orff's Schulwerk, the emphasis is creativity, getting the student to create an idea that is theirs. And in Dahlcrows, that is merely a tool to getting a student to have a greater understanding of the concept, and it brings it home to a theoretical understanding of whatever that concept is. And so there are a lot of instances, like lessons that we had at the Dahlcrows Academy, that I was like, this is an Orff lesson, because like I bring it home, like we do all the things and I'm like, yeah, this is what it looks like. But in a Dahlcrows lesson, I think that is like knowing where it's going is the centerpiece of like making it all come together. It's not just about the experiences and creating based on the experiences. It's about saying, and we have arrived, here is the name for that thing. And oftentimes it's about connecting it to composed music. So it's very much led by the teacher from the piano. You could technically use whatever instrument you're comfortable playing, but the piano is an orchestral instrument. And so there's a lot of cool things that you can do with like your right hand representing the upper body and your left hand representing the lower body. And then when their jobs switch, you switch what you're doing from hand to hand. It demands a lot on the teacher as a musician.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
So
it seems like two things, correct me again, because like that's going to be the phrase of today's episode. Correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like point one, it's that Dahlcrows, there's a point of destination.
Mm-hmm.
While Schulwerk, the Schulwerk is like, that can be definitely part of it. It can also definitely be the experience. It's a little more broad.
Yes. Like I was talking with a colleague, Michael Groff, if you're listening, about how aimless the Schulwerk can feel.
Mm-hmm.
It has the potential to be that way. And I'm really generalizing here because, yeah. I mean, each teacher teaches differently. And obviously, like, good teachers are thinking of the destination. But you can get so wrapped up in an Orff Schulwerk activity. You're like, what are we learning? I don't know, but we're making things. And that's really cool. Like, and be satisfied with that as an Orff mm-hmm. teacher. Like, do they know what it's called? Do they need to know what it's called? Do they ever need to know how to read music? Like, I mean, I have teetered back and forth on the value of music literacy, mm-hmm. Western notation. Like, is that the pinnacle of what we're teaching?
Right.
And so there's value in that. But with Dahlcrows, you have all of these experiences so that it brings it home to this tangible concept.
Yeah.
This is where we were going the whole time. Everything that we did in this lesson set up this moment. And now let's look at how Brahms used it in this piece.
Mm-hmm. Two things come to mind. Thing one, this has actually been, that's been a point of contention amongst my friends that I took level one with, like just now that many, many moons have passed since then. And it's that element of, we learned a lot. But did we learn? like we learned a lot as far as our ability to make music. But then can we prove to our administration, did they learn a lot? And that, like, I feel like you can, depending on the teacher. Can mm-hmm. but Dahlcrows, it's a little more poignant, it's a little more to the point, exactly.
Yeah, so like you're doing things where you're, a lot of the activities, well, we talked about like different reaction games, mm-hmm. which is something mm-hmm. I became fascinated with after Beth Ann Hepburn's masterclass. She showed us a bunch of quick reaction games, and actually a lot of the things that are printed in the volumes today are sketches from quick reaction activities that they did at the Gunther-Schule way back when. So there's all these quick reaction things, but they're really assessment opportunities. Like when you hear this, do this thing. But when you hear this, do this thing. And so you just go along, and when you change whatever, if you change modes or if you throw in a 5 chord or like whatever you've told them to listen for, are they doing that thing? Cool. They just show that they got it. Like, or if when you hear this rhythm, pat with a partner, or that's your rhythmic dictation. Now you know that they know what it is, and you didn't have them sit down with pencil and paper and write it down. Although that is somewhere that you can take that, but you're assessing their understanding of the concept. And within that, there's room for them to create with it, to improvise. A big tenet of Dalcos is adaptation. And I was really impressed by just how chill the whole faculty was, because they live by that. Like, they're just, you know, everything, like, it's okay, throw whatever you want at me, like, we adapt, everything's fine, like, you're never going to surprise me because I can just roll with it. And that just exudes from them and their personality. But it's true, like, when something came up and there was some kind of obstacle, I don't know, they put a traffic cone over it in the middle of our solfège room.
Oh, what? Sorry.
A traffic cone over
Oh,
some kind of
traffic
like
cone. Okay, gotcha.
yeah a traffic cone over some kind of bump in the tile. We're gonna adapt around it, it's no big deal. Like, everything is just like, oh, if you make a mistake, just catch the next one, like, no big deal. So there's a lot of parallels between Dalcos and Orph, but it just kind of depends on what you're drawing inspiration from. Like, do you really want to go deep into this activity where students are creating? Like, is that the pinnacle of this lesson? And again, like, that could be a piece that scaffolds in or goes into identifying the thing. Like, it's hard to draw the line, like, this is Orph and this is
Sure,
Dalcos, because
sure.
there it's very blurry. There's a lot of overlap between the two.
My next question, and maybe this isn't meant for someone who's still pursuing the path towards Dalcroze certification. Yes, that's what they call
A professional certificate is the
it.
first level of certification. Yes,
Okay,
there are
okay.
multiple.
You mentioned piano, and you've mentioned a lot of, like, because it comes from Europe, a lot of European composers. Can you see Dalcroze? I guess this is applicable to any real pedagogy, but can you see Dalcroze utilized outside of Europe? And are there people also pursuing that actively, like making an effort to do that?
That is something that I was pondering through the course. I think that I need to study with a variety of different Dalcos teachers. And I've been listening to the podcast, The New Dalcosian. It's Anthony Molinaro and Lauren Hodson, just to kind of like figure out, make connections, and process through this whole experience. I have never met either of them, but I love their podcast. And the Dalcroze Society is a very small organization. I know that there are lots of communities of Dalcroze globally. I was pondering, like, how do you get away from centering European music? And I think it just depends on the teacher and what their values are. A teacher who has a lot of European experience, or like that is all that they know, is obviously going to center that. But there's a big community down in Latin America. There were quite a few people from China and Japan and Taiwan at this course. And I think it just depends on the teacher and if you're willing to seek out that repertoire. It's not limited to the white men who wrote things down, and now that we have them, they're dead, but we still have their stuff because they wrote it down. It's not limited to that. I mean, it opens up a whole bigger question to, like, where is the music that was lost because it wasn't written down? We have this music because it was documented.
Right.
Where is the music that we don't even know? How can we represent music that we don't know exists? But I did try to process through that. And I will say that at this particular course, it was very Eurocentric. I don't know if that was on purpose. I can see Dalcos being a scaffold to teach a variety of things. So if you are in your culture wanting to share a different culture or wanting to teach a different subject, there are ways to have students have experiences, whatever that concept is, to put that concept in the body. Like one of the instructors was talking about how in Switzerland, Delcro's approach is used to teach life skills, tying your shoes, brushing your teeth. Like okay. you put these things in the body. So I think it just depends on the person teaching it and their priorities and what they know about the world around them and their intentionality in their own classroom.
That's cool. Well put. First off, you mentioned that AOSA helped fund you going to Masterclass and Memphis. Did you do the Delcros on your own, or
the American Center for Elemental Music and Movement gave me a scholarship to go to the Delcros Academy.
Shout out to ASM. Thank you so much, ASM.
Yes, they have a Beacon Scholar program, and it was a real simple Google Form application where I just said, here's what I would do if you gave me some money, and they just sent me a check. So
I feel like there's a lot of, first off, how did you find out ASM was granting this?
Christina Reardon.
Okay.
She was last year's Beacon Scholar. That's how she came to SMU. And so yeah, she told me about it. And so I kind of had a year to think about, what do I want to do? Like, do I want to do more ORF? I don't want to be siloed as like that ORF person, like, oh, Olivia only does ORF. What are some other things that I want to know? And I had signed up for one of the American Eurythmic Society courses last summer, but there weren't enough people in the class, so they cut it. And then I met Dr. Jeremy Dittes, came to Commerce, Texas to do a Delcros masterclass. He's a diplome superior, which is the highest level of Delcros certification that you can achieve.
Do you get a red robe for it?
Hmm?
Do you get a red robe for it?
Maybe. But you can only get that one in Geneva, Switzerland.
Oh, so okay.
Yeah, it's a big deal. There are not, I think there's 12 Americans who have it.
Wow.
It's a big deal. And so he came out to Commerce, and I drove 2 hours. That was 2 hours from Fort Worth. I drove 2 hours to here because I wanted to know more. And it totally blew my mind. And so I talked to him about, you know, how can I learn more? And he actually does study during the academic year. So he offers Eurythmics classes like twice a month through the academic year, so you can continue your studies. Because truthfully, if you're only taking the Delcros Academy in the summertime, it's just going to take a lot longer to get through that certification. It's not like ORF levels where you just like come back and right. come back and come back. There are exams in piano improvisation, in solfège, in eurythmics, and you have to pass the level 3 certification exam in each of those categories. So like right now I have passed solfège and eurythmics, and I had a conflict with the test date for piano improvisation, but like truthfully, I need to work on my piano skills a little more before I feel ready for that exam. But if I was stagnant, if I stopped what I'm doing and waited till next summer, then I would be in level 2 solfège and eurythmics and level 1 piano improv.
So it seems pretty extensive. Like
it is. And okay. Some of the level 3s were saying that it's more work than they did for the master's programs that they've been in. And it's a lot, because there's the exams, but there's also a pedagogy piece where you have to work with a diplome to evaluate your teaching skills. So you're submitting videos of yourself teaching. You also have to write several papers and contribute to the field.
Wow.
Extensive.
It seems almost like it's on the academic level,
it is.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yes. There's some people who have completed all the coursework but just haven't done the papers yet, and that's the only thing keeping them from having their certificate. It is extensive work, and that's just the first level. You can continue your studies and get your professional license. And then after that, the next level is a diplome. And Jeremy was saying that in his audition for the diplome program, he had to improvise a sonata. amongst other things, but that was
okay.
One
okay.
Yeah.
You better get a red robe by the end of that. If that, if that, if nothing else, like you choose your color, but like, wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot, but you know that somebody who has that knows what they're doing.
Sure, that's true. Yeah, I know you're posting images of you pulling out back in university. We called it the bob. I don't know if that's what they called it, or what's the spiral, the sight singing.
Oh yeah, the Ottman.
Yeah, it's Bob Ottman. So we call it the Bob. Bob and Bono is what we did back in university. So it's like, I wondered if that bring any PTSD from university times for you or not. I don't know.
It did. But then upon flipping through it, I realized how much I've grown and how, I won't say that I could just like sing anything for you right now, but like, I was like, oh yeah, like I remember looking at this, like it was written in Greek when I was 19 years old. But I know some of these words.
Maybe it's as if maybe now that it's in your body, you can actually do it better.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And that book was a resource for our own practice. We didn't
actually use
that in class. They were giving us tools. Like everything was experiencing things in the body. So solfege class was not like college ear training. It was and moving with tennis balls and hula hoops and games, and all of the things that we did helped solidify my understanding. There's this one activity that was part of our exam called the chord samba. And it's a chord progression that you have to be able to sing on letter names or numbers, like scale degrees, and they can call switch at any time.
That sounds amazingly fun.
You're like A C E A C E A C F A C F A D F A D F F G E D. Didn't screw that up already. I probably did. F E D. Really messed it up.
No, F E D. Yeah.
I'm gonna think backward. F E D C B. But at any point they can say switch, and you have to switch from letters to numbers. So the whole time in your head, you're holding on to, if A is one,
right,
then B
right.
is two, and C is
three. Because they do fixed dough, right? There are fixed dough peoples. Or no? Oh.
Yes, but they have a workaround.
Okay.
So we did letter names and scale degrees.
Okay.
And
scale
so we
degrees,
did not do do re mi.
Okay. I feel like we can go way more deeper into this, but just to respect our time, I have three questions. I had three questions. We really went into the weeds of that. First off, I feel like there should be like there's a lot of resources out there, and I feel like if you are an institution that does scholarships, let us know at Chaotic Harmony. We'd love to just like shout you out, because I think one of the biggest inhibitors, we talked actually before we hit record, Olivia and I were talking about how ORF levels, like they're big, there's been a big barrier is just money in general. And so like, it'd be great to shout any institution out that does scholarships. So let us know.
I can say about that. I had never paid for my own courses at all until this Dalcroze workshop, because the Beacon Scholarship only is up to $1,000. So they gave me $1,000. I had to cover the rest. But whether it's from my fine arts department or my campus, one of my favorite things to do is towards the end of the year, go ask my principal if there's any money that needs to get spent, because that money goes away. If they don't spend it, they don't get it in their budget the next year. So end of the year is a great time to go ask your principal if there's any money that needs spending. I'm like, I know how to spend it.
How many months before the end of the...
What's that?
How many months or how many weeks? Because I feel like there is a threshold.
I would say, well, I don't know. Like, I know your academic calendar is a little bit different than mine. My school year ends like late May, and I might go like late April.
Okay, a month before.
Yeah, and just kind of see like, is there any money out there? I've had my campus fund things. I've had my PTA fund things. I've had my district fund things. I've gotten scholarships through my local ORF chapter. I've gotten scholarships through AOSA, through the American Center for Elemental Music and Movement. Because I am not a wealthy person and I wouldn't be able to do these things out of my own pocket, but the
Wait,
money is there.
teachers aren't like money makers? What?
Rolling in it.
What? So yeah, like, I think, yeah, just ask. There's a lot of 501c3s that want to give money and like need to give money. So ask. Two more questions before we get to our roll it up. First off, I think I'm gonna ask the first one actually. So first off, as someone now who has been in the secondary world, going back to that, and who's been very invested in the elemental world, what are words you would say to your middle school feeder schools that are looking to just have their elementary schools have them read music? You know, make sure their priority is to read music. Like, what's the language you would use to convince them that what we do has worth?
I have been thinking about that for at least 6 months now. We have our state music education conference every February. One of the conversations that arose out of that was, how do we bridge that elementary to middle school transition? And I can say, like, when I was teaching secondary, I was absolutely guilty of thinking that learning was not happening in the elementary classroom. That when I got my students in sixth grade, that they were a blank slate, like whatever y'all were doing, like that didn't matter. It wasn't important and it wasn't serious and it wasn't real music. Now we get to do real music.
They're just playing.
Right. Like that was, I mean, and that's all I had been taught.
Nobody, sure.
And I say that, and maybe somebody had taught me differently, but that's just not where I was. Like, I didn't have any positive experiences with elementary music. Honestly, in college, I was like, that's where you go if you don't know what you're doing. It was Diane Lang at UTA when I took music learning theory that was like, you don't need to be a good musician to be a band director. You read a score and you wave a stick around. Like, you don't have to be a good musician. That's not saying that there aren't good musicians who are band directors, but you don't
Sure.
have to be one. But you cannot be a bad musician in an elementary music room because you are it for them. You are their model. You can't mess that up. You hold so much in your hands. It's too important. It's too valuable. So one of the questions, or one of the conversations that came up out of the Texas Music Educators Conference was, how do we bridge that? How do we, you know, there's a lot of districts that talk about vertical alignment, elementary understanding what a student is expected to know by the time they get into middle school, and that onus is put on the elementary teacher. But I think that there needs to be some kind of translation where elementary teachers are able to communicate to a middle school teacher, like, these are the skills that your students are coming out of elementary school with. All you need to do is rename some things, but your students know how to improvise. They know how to arrange. Like, instead of just doing long tones on F, which has value, but if that's all you're doing, your kids are going to get bored and they're going to quit. So how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep these rudimentary skills that are necessary when you're learning a new instrument? I mean, you do have to talk about the technical stuff, but how do you take those technical things and make them music? And how do you understand what the skill set is coming out of elementary school and know that they were making music and that music was valid and that their choices are valid? It takes me back to when I was in ORF Level 1. Meg Teets was my ORF Level 1 instructor, and we were talking in a big circle sometime during week two, just kind of processing through where we were at. And something she said just gutted me. She said, you have to believe that you are not the only musician in the room. And I swear, like, it was just a knife to the heart, because I just had this, like, you know, in the movies where you like flash back through your whole life.
Sure.
And I just flashed through my entire career. And I was like, I don't think that we've ever made music. We certainly didn't my first year of teaching elementary, because I tried to teach it like band. Like, come on, kindergarten, sit
right,
in your
right.
chair. What's so hard? Look, I'm telling you all about music. That's a chord note. Like, but I reflected back on my experience as a secondary teacher and how many times I stood at the front of the room and said, we're going to shape it this way because I went to school for this. And if you do this long enough, then you too can be a musician, a real
yeah.
musician like me.
Yeah, that's how we were taught. And it keeps on perpetuating downwards. But like, You're right. Music making should be communal. And
that is what I would tell a secondary teacher. You have to believe that you are not the only musician in that room.
I love that. I think there definitely needs to be, I agree, there's definitely always a command from above downwards, but rarely is there a conversation. Mm-hmm. It's all, you know what? You can strike me with whatever words you want, secondary teachers, but it almost feels like that's similar to how a lot of secondary teachers teach. Like they are commanding what is from those who are lower, for lack of a better term. But I love that. I was
talking with a colleague last week, one of the secondary teachers, during, I had new hire training last week, and they were talking about like boosting numbers in their programs. It was like, I get if you're the director of that program, that is a concern of yours. But I was blunt. I was like, my number one priority is not funneling kids into band or choir. My number one priority is giving children positive experiences with music. Because I remember being in high school and thinking that the only valid outlet for being a musician is being in a school music program. And my friends who were playing in garage bands or like playing at their churches or doing anything that wasn't part of the band program, that they were not legit musicians.
Right.
Some of those people have made careers out of being musicians and are still playing today. And you can't believe that any child who's not in your program is not a musician. Like these kids are going to go out. And even if they do join a musical fine art, the statistic on who makes a career out of that is something like 1%. And if I'm trying to teach every single kid to be a performer in a symphony or an opera or some kind of performing arts where they're doing it as a career, I'm going to get the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. Now, does it warm my heart when they want to sign up for those programs? Absolutely. I love it. But that is not my number one priority. And I think when our priorities are in alignment, we will get those numbers up because kids will love music. But if our number one focus is you got to join band, you got to join choir, they're just going to push back against that.
And also you got to join this specific style of music. And I think this is a conversation that we can maybe save for another time. Maybe when I do fly out to Texas, and as much as I just poo-pooed upon secondary teachers inadvertently, my apologies, but like also like they are placed under the pressure that they can only teach under band, orchestra, choir, which is there is more. And I know they recognize there's more. So I will concede my apologies.
I mean, I'm speaking from my experience.
Sure,
and
sure.
The things that I thought, and I, again, am just myself and I have grown a lot. And I'm not saying that, like I said, it's not that you can't be a good musician and be a band director. Mm-hmm.
But
you can't be a bad musician and teach elementary music.
Fact. My last question, because again, I feel like we could just keep this rolling, but we got places to be. And also, you're 2 hours ahead of me. So,
yeah. It's fine. The kids are at grandma's house.
Well, speaking of kids, like you are very active, very, very active. It's like something I mentioned from the beginning. Something that I've seen on your Instas is that you're extremely active in the elemental community and you've pursued masterclass, you've pursued a new vertical of elemental music, Dalcroze, and you're a mom. Mm-hmm. You're a mom of multiple kids. Four kids?
Four.
Whew!
Yeah.
Okay. And like, what is your words of wisdom to people who want to pursue, like, who want to delve, but also are recognized, like, that they recognize that they also have burdens outside of teaching, like, be it being having a family. Like, how do you do what you do? I guess that's my question. How do you do what you do? And what are your words of wisdom on how to juggle the many plates that you do?
I don't know that I can say that I do it well. I will say that I don't have it figured out, and it is a lot. I mean, it's hard. It's hard. Like you want to be like, if I'm great at my job, then I'm not the best mom. But if I'm being the best mom, then I'm not great at my job. And I like to be good at my job. Like I that lights a fire in me. So I guess one. So Meg Teeds, I could talk about her. We could have talked about her the entire time. Like she's my ORF mom. She's a great mentor to me. I love her. And I remember talking to her kind of about that same topic, the balance of being a mom and doing this work. And one thing that really stuck with me was her saying that she wants her kids to see a mom who wanted what she has and got it and did what it took to get where she is. And I'm probably butchering her words, but like I basically being that inspirational female figure in her children's life that, you know, she is a mom and she does that so well, but we are multidimensional people. And I am a mom, but I also like to lift weights and I also like to like go do things in my town. And I like to make music and I like to teach music. And I'm so many different things. And I mean, that is, I don't know if I can answer that. Like, I don't have an answer. I'm still trying to figure out how to do it well. Yeah, it's, and my kids are very young. They're 8, 8, 5, and 3. I think maybe as they get older, I'll be able to feel comfortable bringing them to things, but like they're too young and so needy. So like, we're very blessed to have family in the area, to help them have a place to be. Like they're at my mom's right now so that I can not have children screaming in the background of the podcast. But yeah, like I am still, that is definitely something that I'm still trying to figure out.
Sure.
And they keep changing and their needs keep changing. So anytime I find something that works, it doesn't work for long. So.
It's almost as if, from what I'm gathering, you know what you would like from this life. You're pursuing it. And even though there's a lot of barriers, you recognize that perfection is not required from you, and you can just, and even though things will slip up, you still, that's not going to inhibit you from pursuing the things that you want to pursue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, it's a lot of navigating, you know, what is best for my kids and does like, how do I fit? How do I make it? Like, I want to have it all. And it, I mean, that's the reason why when my twins were born, I was still teaching secondary and I did that for 2 more years because I was like, I'm superwoman. I can have it all. Like I can do this and have kids. And what I didn't realize was all the moments that I was missing at home. I was a first time mom. And because I was just like fully immersed in my work, I really wasn't being a mom. It felt like life hadn't changed a whole lot. My husband was practically a single dad. And then when he wanted to go back to school, that was the impetus for change. And so I definitely don't have sage advice on how to do it all. And like, that's something that I give grace for, like thinking about, you know, the barriers to entry to doing ORF levels or other areas of study.
Mm-hmm.
What are the things that we can do? I know in Memphis, they are restructuring their summer kids camp. They have a summer, like an ORF levels for kids kind of thing. And they put it during the first week of their ORF levels so that the students at that course could go watch this in action with human children. And that got me thinking, like, could that be something that we could develop at the SMU course? And could that then give parents a lowered barrier to entry because there is a place for their kids to be? And so I think that my experience as a mom like definitely influences how I see those things and think about those things. I don't have answers right now. They're all just ideas.
Yeah.
But like, I want, like one of my passions is teaching teachers and showing teachers that you are capable of doing this And here are some ways to lower the barriers to entry. And sometimes it's completely valid. Like you have kids and they have soccer on Saturdays and you can't go to that chapter workshop, or you can't volunteer to serve on a committee, or you worked 5 days this week and you don't want to give up your Saturday, or you don't, like, you don't have childcare for 2 weeks in the summer. Like, I get all of that. But that's definitely something on my mind. Like, how do we lower this barrier to entry? How do we, like, I mean, another barrier is just the cost. Like, it's just really expensive and ever increasing. And what are some ways that we can lower that cost? Like, obviously there are like non-negotiables. You have to pay your staff. You have to pay the, for the, like, I don't know. I feel like we could talk about this for a long time.
Yeah. We got a lot of micro points. Like, we can make multiple episodes off of, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I guess long story short is I don't know how to do it well. I'm trying.
You're still exploring. Seems like you're still, okay, but you're still doing it. You're still doing it, which is awesome. Well, Olivia, this has been a really great conversation. Thank you so much. We'll do Spiccato then after the break.
I want to take a quick break and thank my husband, Brian, who's been working behind the scenes producing these episodes every week on all of the platforms and on time. But you need to know that he is first a financial planner for Mission Trails Financial. Mission Trails Financial is a partner that seeks to guide clients in the journey to financial success. They believe that people need a financial advisor that aims to provide strategies for success. Mission Trails Financial helps people navigate investments, tax planning, and insurance. Imagine working with an advisor who isn't tied to specific brands. Mission Trails Financial has a fiduciary responsibility to act in the best interests of their clients by providing independent, objective advice. Their mission is to help clients accomplish their financial goals. As Joe Vitale once said, a goal should scare you a little and excite you a lot. Do yourself a favor and set up a time to chat with Mission Trails Financial. Visit www.missiontrailsfinancial.com or call 619-419-0238 to schedule a call. You'll be glad you did. We believe that leaning on professionals is how we get ahead. Check out the program notes for more information.
Welcome back to Chaotic Harmony. We had to do a bit of a tech change because last time we recorded, there were some issues going on, but we're back. And so if you're a video listener, I guess also if you're an audio listener, you might hear some differences. But that all said, welcome back. And before we get to our spiccato, a hard left turn, thank you everyone for being part of this 95 episode journey. It means a lot to hear your comments and also to meet people like you, Olivia. just run into you and just say, hey, I know you. So, but anyways, it's been a wonderful 6 years. And if you want to help keep this going, support the things you love. Find us on patreon.com/chclassroom. We have a bunch of stuff, and feel free to leave us a buck. And we have you know, merch if you want to receive that through there, and also some lesson ideas as well. And if you can't support us monetarily, that's okay. This podcast is meant to be free, but do leave us a review. Like, seriously, I'm tired of seeing B. Arbra on Apple Podcasts. I love you. I don't know who you are, I think, but I love you. But just leave us a review. Come on. And, you know, some of you said you would, and what's going on here? Anywho, and you can also post a nice comment on our YouTube video, and feel free to tell us, tell your friends about us. That all said, spiccato. We're going to do something a little bit different today because I am running out of things to, I mean, I had an object, but then I realized, oh wait, we already did this. So we're actually going to do this, like, our classic spiccato. So I don't know, Olivia, have you, like, you listened to some of our earlier stuff? Okay.
Yes.
All right. So I'm just going to spit fire some questions, and whatever first comes to your brain, please answer. I'm not going to hold a timer, but you know, just lightning round, whatnot. So what is the best song written in the last 100 years?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's different, that I think that was written in the last 100 years.
Whatever comes from your heart.
Okay, so this is like those moments where, like, suddenly, like, you've never heard a song before.
And no Oscar routine where you say, I'd like to thank this person. And no, it's just me one.
Okay. How about, Thanks for the Memories by Fall Out Boy.
Okay. Classic. Awesome. if you could only kill one, which would you kill? French toast, pancakes, or waffles?
Pancakes.
Okay. I'm with you there, actually, but rest in peace. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm glad, you know, I you know, the first time we met, he's like, I got you. You know, I felt that. Where would you, and this one you can take a little longer, where would you want to be in your teaching and personal career in 5 years? What do you want to, what do you see yourself doing?
Teaching and personal life?
Sure. Or whichever one comes to you.
Definitely teaching. One of my career goals is to become a teacher educator for the American Orchestral Work Association. We've kind of talked about that. And hopefully within the next 5 years, I will also have completed my DOCRA's professional certification.
And get the red robe?
Well, that's not quite the red robe level. No,
okay,
like stage one.
So maybe the green one.
Yeah. So yeah, those are my professional goals. Personally, hopefully we're in the process of getting a bigger house because our kids are growing. So hopefully settle down into our new house with our growing children. And within 5 years, I'm going to have teenagers. So I'm buckling up for that.
Awesome. Awesome. And also, which area do you wish to lean into for your to be a TE? Like
basic pedagogy. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
That's where my heart is called.
Cool. And lastly, do you have any questions for me? I know it's because of, I feel like this would have flowed much better if we had a contiguous interview, but alas, do you have any questions for me?
Yeah. What was it like being a course director for the first time?
Oof. Wow. I think I shared a lot about that in the last episode. There was a lot of changes happening. We went from having our district be in charge of the financials to our chapter. So there was a lot of logistical elements learning from that. And I think this being a levels director really forced me to, and I'm not there yet, but forced me to lean into, hey, you got to ask for help. And I really don't like asking for help. It's something I'm working on, but there's no way we could do good stuff without a community. I think of something that Franklin Willis posted recently about an African proverb: if you want to do something quickly, do it yourself. If you want something, and this is, I'm paraphrasing, if you want to do something that lasts a long time, ask others. So
yeah.
It was a lot, especially since we had the big Rona hit us, but you know, in the end we made it work. So yeah, that's what it was like. Thank
Very
you for
asking. Cool. Yeah, of course. I got added to the AOSA course directors Facebook group.
Oh, didn't know there
know
was
how.
a
I'll add you. I don't know how.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, we're going to jump into our next segment. This is a new segment. Since this is an online Zoom video or doing rounds, it doesn't work so well as we collectively learned in 2020. But this new segment is called Chaotic Kitty. So inspired by game shows like Family Feud, and in particular for me, Kinda Funny's game show, we're kind of trying this out. We surveyed our audience a bunch of questions, and 30 people responded. And before I get back to the rules, if there's any way you'd like us to send these survey questions out, or just in questions in general, you the listeners, and if there's a way that's better than Instagram stories, let us know. Write to us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com if you have a better way of us disseminating information. 30 is a great number, but we'd love to have more be a part of this to make this interesting. Anyways, so we surveyed 30 of y'all, and so we have 6 of those questions that I'm going to ask Olivia. If she guesses the top answer, or I guess we'll stick to the whole Olympics theme, gold. If she gets the gold answer, she'll get 30 points. Second best, or silver, she'll get 20 points. And for bronze, 10 points. And if she can get at least 60 points in these 6 questions, then she'll win. And what you'll win, Olivia, is our first edition Chaotic Harmony t-shirt. So, do you like pink?
I do.
Okay, snaps. All right. And if you blow away the points, maybe we'll have to change this whole system for the next guest. We'll figure it out. This is our first time. You know, we'll figure it out. So are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm so ready.
Okay. Our first question is, as I flip through some windows. All right. What's a first name that's commonly used in folk songs?
Like once again, John, John or Johnny.
John
or
Johnny.
Are those interchangeable? Do I have to pick one?
So
I'll say John.
John. All right. We'll just say the answer. So our first, for that, you get our gold answer. So we did John and Johnny. That got the most points. Next one is, name a children's book whose main character is a BBIA or Black, Brown, Indigenous, Asian child. So name a book that features a BBIA child.
Olumide from Your Name is a Song.
And for that, you get the 20-point answer. Oh, actually, you know what? Let's go back. So the first question, you got your gold answer. So that's John and Johnny. I got 10 responses. Sally was in second place, and Liza Jane was in third. Mm. So heads up. As far as for the children's book, you got a silver answer for 20 points. So you have a total of 50 points at the moment. Our gold answer for that was Snowy Day. And our bronze answer was Eyes That Kiss at the Corners.
Oh, those are good ones.
They are good ones, yeah. Next off, scrolling down. Name a children's publishing company. Name a children's publishing book company. Sorry, children's publishing book company.
Children's book. Penguin.
Penguin. For that, you get the gold answer as well. Hey, so 30.
Oh, yeah, plus 30 plus
50, so you got it. You got it. So maybe we'll have to revise next time. But 30 plus 30 plus 20. We got what? 80? 80 points. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So Penguin is gold, tied with Scholastic. And then for
that is a children's book.
I know. When people post that, oh yeah, that's right. God. And then for bronze, so those got 7 points each, and then just by 1 point, we are friends at Flat Books. They got
that did cross my mind, but I thought those were more like books for adults to use with children. But maybe there are children's books.
Maybe I need to revise my question. But that was actually more people got at least the ethos of my question. It was like, what is a book that adults can use for children? Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Well, let's see for funsies. Let's see if you can get 120 points.
Okay.
There's nothing extra you get, but alas. On a scale from 1 to 10, how ready are teachers after summer break?
Like a 8?
Eight was our. Oh, it wasn't even top three. It only got one vote. So, And our last question for today is, name a book you love using in your classroom.
I Am Every Good Thing. I did a program with it last year. It was magical. I love that book.
I Am Every Good Thing sadly did not get the top three. And this one was hard because a lot of people had a lot of, like there was just a widespread, which is why, again, peoples, like, send us your responses so that we can, like, get bolstered. Because our top answer was Your Name is a Song.
Oh.
Then tied for second was Little Cloud, and then also Little Lady Who Was Not Afraid of Anything. But sorry, what was the name of the book you mentioned? I Am Every Good Thing. Yeah, that was definitely up there. So
okay.
Yeah, cool. But that all said, you got a total of 80 points. So congratulations, you got our first edition Chaotic Harmony T-shirt.
Yay!
Hey. Olivia, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation, being part of this episode. Is there anything you want to plug, or like you want to like let the peoples know?
Yeah, I kind of talked about it in the interview, but like the American Orff Schulwerk Association gives out lots of money. And from what I have heard, I haven't seen the facts, but what I've heard is a lot of people don't apply. So chances of getting funding are pretty high. So join that organization, because you have to be a member in order to reap the benefits. They have scholarships. Then the American Center for Elemental Music and Movement also gives out money. And then the Dalcroze Society of America also gives out money. So there's lots of money out there. You just have to know where to ask. And awesome. Yeah.
I love how you like shout it out. I was more talking about your, like, I was wondering if you would lean into it, because I saw on one of your posts that you are reaching out to people's for, you know, as you are to, you're looking to what's to be a work to workshop for other people. Or so I don't know if you wanted to.
Absolutely. Yes. I am located in the North Texas area. And I have been building up my workshop repertoire to one of my favorite things is to teach teachers. And it's a professional goal of mine to become a teacher educator for the American Orchestral Work Association. That's just something that I aspire to do. It fills my cup to teach other people, because there, I was that person once upon a time who knew nothing. And I have gone out and tried to learn as much. I hope I never think I have it figured out, but I've learned a lot, and I love sharing that with other people and empowering people to believe that they can do this work too. So call me. I'm on Facebook. My Instagram is Oh Hey Olivia, OHHEYYYOLIVIA. So you can reach me on the socials. And I would love to talk about coming out and showing people the magic of the shul work. So
we'd love to have you over here for sure.
Yes, I've never been to California.
Yeah, have you ever been?
I have, but we did a bowl game in San Diego once, but most of my California exploration has been more like northern.
Gotcha.
I marched with the Santa Clara Vanguard.
Okay, very cool. Well, if you come down to San Diego, are we down compared to you? I don't know. If you come over to San Diego, we'll definitely show you our favorite taco shop. But that all said, enough about tacos. You can find me at Mr. Seligman, MrSeligman on all the socials. I'm not as active as I used to be, but I'm trying to be a little more. I'm kind of getting over that Elon Musk element of X. And so, you know, just trying to be out there more. And also, you can find us at CH Classroom on the socials. And also feel free to email us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com. Olivia, it was a wonderful conversation. I wish you the best this school year, and I wish everyone else the best. Take care, y'all. Bye.
Bye.
The Chaotic Harmony Podcast is a joint project between Crystal Pridmore and Jonathan Seligman. You can find us online at chaoticharmonyclassroom.com. You can email us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com and let us know what you think. Give us feedback about what you would like to hear in future episodes. We're on all the socials. Find us on facebook.com/chaoticharmonyclassroom. You can find us on Twitter at chclassroom, Instagram at chaoticharmonyclassroom, and you can even find our episodes on YouTube. Chaotic Harmony is the name of our channel. Special thanks to Brian Pridmore for his help with production and equipment. www.pridmoria.com.